The headlines. Iran's foreign minister says Tehran's relations with Damascus are strategic as he arrives in the Syrian capital on an official visit. Iraq is preparing for Sunday's parliamentary elections, which are held a year earlier than the scheduled time. Also in the headlines, the British government comes under pressure to resolve an ongoing energy crisis that is threatening the closure of factories. Welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has arrived in the Syrian capital, Damascus, where he was welcomed by his counterpart, Faisal Miqdad. Upon arrival, the top Iranian diplomat described Tehran-Damascus relations as strategic. He said that Iran seeks to forge closer cooperation with Syria on all fronts. Amir Abdollahian said that Iran will continue to stand by the Arab country, as it did during Syria's war on terror. The Syrian Foreign Minister in turn said Damascus supports Tehran's efforts with regard to its nuclear issue. He said that Syria strongly condemns Washington's moves aimed at playing with Iran's nuclear program and other regional affairs. Amir Abdollahian arrived in Damascus after concluding his trip to Beirut, where he held talks with senior Lebanese officials. Iran's ambassador to the UN says sanctions violate the basic principles of human rights, including the right to development. Earlier in the news review program, we discussed the issue in detail with our guests.
Hello everyone and welcome to the News Review program where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Iran's ambassador to the United Nations says the sanctions violate basic principles of human rights, including the right to development. Majid Takht-Ravanchi said the sanctions prevent governments from accessing executive means to achieve progress and development. He was speaking at the UN General Assembly's Economic and Financial Committee. The envoy slammed U.S. unilateral measures as well as the world community's inaction in the face of such behavior. Takht-Ravanchi noted that coercive U.S. measures are targeting health systems of countries still grappling with the coronavirus pandemic. He stressed that those illegal measures hamper not only development goals, but also constitute a crime against humanity. Joining us now for the program is Mr. Jim Cavanaugh, founder of the Polemicist.net from New York, and Ramiro Fuentes, journalist and political commentator, joining us from Los Angeles, California. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Jim, I guess we'll start with you. Hope you're safe and doing well. Your initial thoughts on crippling sanctions, basically an obstacle to a country's development, and, you know, basically which constitutes, you know, a standard of well-being for humans that these countries are denied and these people are denied.
Yes, this has become the standard American way of doing non-business, I guess you'd say, in the world. I mean, the countries that the United States doesn't like, they institute a program of siege economic siege warfare against them. And the sanctions are meant to create social problems and economic problems for the people of the country that the United States hopes will inspire them to rise up against the government. That rarely happens. It just hurts the people of the country, and it hurts their social and economic situation. So, you know, this is a standard policy of the United States now. That's the way they try and get their goals in the world, is through, if it's not military action directly, it's through economic siege warfare. And Iran is one of their prime targets. I did see that they lifted a couple of sanctions today on a couple of Iranian companies. So maybe they want to try and get the Iranians to back into the negotiations and push that forward a lot. I'm very skeptical about that. But this is the standard operating procedure for the United States now, economic siege warfare.
Thank you, Jim. And Ramiro, welcome to the program. Hope you're doing well out there in Los Angeles. And Ramiro, it's not just Iran, is it? There is a handful of countries that their civilian populations are crippled and don't really have the right to the kind of standard of living in other countries, and people that are completely apolitical, but they're being bludgeoned by these sanctions.
That's exactly right. And just as the other guests mentioned as well, these sanctions hurt poor working class people the most. Iran is one of the hardest hit with sanctions impacting working class families, women, children, families struggling to pay their bills, survive. It impacts infrastructure, it impacts the ability of a nation to develop its economy, and it forms part of the broader strategy of hybrid warfare, where sanctions and corporate news media are used together to demonize any country or system that is opposed to Wall Street and London. And so what it does is that it creates the problem. It brands Iran, it brands Venezuela, it brands Cuba, Nicaragua, DPRK as so-called state sponsors of terrorism, even though these are the countries that are on the front lines of fighting terrorism. And so it does a complete inversion of reality. It creates the economic problems in those countries by implementing sanctions, by prohibiting companies from trading with Iran, with all these different nations. And then it blames those problems that are created on the policies of the government, as opposed to the sanctions themselves. So there's so many levels to this hybrid warfare. It's psychological, it's mediatic, and that's why it's important for us here at Press TV to have these conversations, because people oftentimes divorce sanctions from real life warfare, and it is an act of warfare.
And Jim, do you think that the U.S. will ever get to a point where it actually finds other ways to poke and prod a government that it does not like, rather than take its wrath out on the people of that population? Basically, you know, do you think we'll get to a point where the U.S. will rethink its sanctions and see the lack of humanity in its sanctions regime?
Short answer, no. The United States, unless there's a kind of radical, not to say revolutionary, upheaval in the political structure of the United States, you know, is going to pursue this. They have policies in regions, you know, and they've been doing this for decades. I mean, the CIA wrote about it in Venezuela, that this is our goal is to destroy the economy. The UN rapporteur for Venezuela said this is crime against humanity. This is siege warfare. It's a crime against humanity. These regimes that the United States doesn't like for whatever reason, because they're too socialistic or have social democratic policies, or because they don't, you know, they're resistant to Israeli hegemony in the case of Iran, unless the United States changes its priorities in that respect, then they're going to continue doing this, because what else do they have to do? You know, they're a little more reluctant to go in with troops right away, so this is the other weapon that they have, and it's a very powerful weapon for poor countries.
Thank you, Jim. And Ramiro, your final thoughts, please.
I think the way out of this mess, the situation, is to create a new anti-imperialist bloc, unity. I'm pleased to know that Iran has been cooperating and trading more with China, with Venezuela, with Nicaragua, with Cuba, building an alternative to the World Trade Organization, to the IMF, to the World Bank, to Wall Street. Because once you build that alternative, and by the way, that means not only in the financial sector, but also in terms of social media, a new Facebook, a new Twitter, a new Instagram, creating an alternative to the empire-run infrastructure. That is the way out of this mess. And I think that Iran and so many other countries that have been sanctioned, that is number one on their priority, moving away from the dollar, moving away from the control of Wall Street and London. And I think that I am very positive and optimistic about the future of this anti-imperialist bloc.
All right, gentlemen, thank you both for joining us on the program. Jim Kavanaugh joining us out of New York, and Ramiro Fuentes joining us from Los Angeles, California. And that's a wrap for this segment of your News Review program. Thanks for joining us, and goodbye for now.
Iraqis are preparing to cast their ballots on Sunday to choose members of a new parliament. More than 25 million people are eligible to vote for a 329-seat legislator. Some groups cast their ballots in early voting on Friday. They included security forces, prisoners, and internally displaced people. A new single-member constituency system for electing lawmakers is supposed to boost independent versus traditional political blocs. Elections are taking place 1 year earlier than the scheduled time. That's an effort to respond to demands raised during protests that broke out in 2019. Those protests called for change and an end to corruption in Iraq. Our correspondent in Baghdad, Wassam Bahrani, told us more about Iraq's parliamentary elections.
They all use the new biometric electronic system made in Germany that part of the election reforms, the legislation that was passed. that they were using that to avoid any vote rigging. And to appease the protesters who were angry at previous elections and the way they were conducted and the way they were run, they've also made more electoral districts, constituencies, if you like, where more candidates, more independent candidates, will have a chance of running. But yesterday we saw a lot of observers, hundreds, many of them from locally in Iraq, as well as many international observers. What we can expect tomorrow, the elections ballot boxes, all the polling stations will open at 7 a.m. They'll close at 6 p.m. We're going to just see a repeat of what we saw during those special elections for special groups on Friday.
Syria has slammed U.S. sanctions on the country as a clear example of economic terrorism. The Syrian envoy to Geneva-based international organizations says the sanctions are in violation of international law and the U.N. Charter. Hossam ad-Din Allah says that a decade of war coupled with unilateral coercive measures have inflicted suffering on the Syrian people. The ambassador has called on the U.S. to lift its sanctions and to end its occupation of Syria's oil fields in the northeast. The U.S. imposed a set of sanctions on Syria in June 2020 under the so-called Caesar Act. It has also deployed troops near Syrian oil reserves and helps Kurdish militants exploit them. The Palestinian president has asked a permanent representative of Palestine to the U.N. to mobilize action at the world body against the Israeli aggression against Al-Aqsa Mosque. Mahmoud Abbas said the Palestinian move will be in coordination with friendly nations. He urged the international community, especially the U.N. Security Council, to put overt pressure on Israel to stop its aggression against the holy site. The remarks came against the backdrop of an Israeli lower court's decision to allow Jews to offer prayers at the Al-Aqsa compound. A Jewish man was slapped with a two-week ban from the compound for quietly praying there last month. On Wednesday, the court, however, lifted the ban, saying that he had not violated the law. The ruling sparked fury among Palestinians in the Muslim world. On Friday, another Israeli court overturned the lower court's decision and upheld the ban. The Chinese President Xi Jinping has vowed to realize a peaceful reunification with Taiwan while reiterating opposition to the self-ruled island's independence bid.
Taiwan independence is the greatest obstacle to national reunification and a serious hidden danger to national rejuvenation. Those who forget their heritage, betray their motherland, and seek to split the country will come to no good, and they will be spurned by the people and condemned by history.
Xi made the comments during his address on an anniversary marking the 1911 revolution. He called the Taiwan question a matter of China's internal affairs, saying that Beijing would not tolerate any outside interference. The Chinese president added that a peaceful reunification would serve the overall interests of the people of the island. Taiwan officials reacted by saying that the future of the island rests in the hands of its people. They called on Beijing to avoid provocative steps. The development comes amid tensions over Taipei's growing military reliance on Washington. China claims its sovereignty over the island under the One China policy. It also condemns U.S.-Taiwan ties and Washington's weapon sales to the island. Author and columnist Einar Tangen says that President Xi's speech indicates that China is determined to reunify with Taiwan.
Just starting with the relations, basically Taiwan has become a pawn in a geopolitical contest where the U.S. is trying to exert pressure in order to contain China. And Taiwan is a useful, as I said, pawn, I guess, is the best way of putting it. So the U.S. has been basically, you know, skirting the edges of the agreements that were made in the 70s and 80s that said that they would not try to enhance Taiwan's attack capabilities. Taiwan now has two missiles, one cruise, one ballistic, that can reach Beijing. In terms of what Xi Jinping has been saying, today he was very, very specific about Taiwan. Xi is trying to make it clear that China is resolved. They were able to come back after 110, after years and years of humiliation, 100 years, and they will continue to reclaim Taiwan as part of their own. It was taken away as part of the Japanese invasion of China, and they're determined to have it back, and that's not surprising.
China says it has urged the U.S. to lift tariffs on Chinese goods during virtual talks between the top trade officials from the two countries. Chinese media say that Beijing also negotiated for the cancellation of sanctions and clarified the country's economic and industrial policies. According to China's Commerce Ministry, U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai and China's Vice Premier Liu He discussed the 2020 Phase 1 trade pact signed under former U.S. President Donald Trump. Washington has described Friday's call as a test of future bilateral engagements. Ahead of the call, a U.S. official accused China pursuing harmful and non-market economic policies. The two countries have long been embroiled in a trade dispute, a feud intensified during Trump's presidency, leading to tit-for-tat tariffs. Russia has broken its daily coronavirus deaths record with 968 fatalities in 24 hours. The government's coronavirus task force also reported over 29,000 new cases in the same period. The country has been reporting record daily coronavirus figures for the past few weeks. Officials say that high infection rates are driven by a more contagious Delta variant and a relatively low vaccination drive. They say new health restrictions are under consideration amid spikes in cases. Currently, Russia is the world's fourth worst-hit country in terms of infections, with more than 7.5 million confirmed cases since the start of the pandemic. The British government is under intense pressure to resolve an ongoing energy crisis that is threatening the closure of factories. Energy-intensive manufacturers say that they are on the verge of halting production and closing down unless the government immediately acts on spiraling natural gas prices. Lawmakers have also urged the government to support factories and businesses struggling with rising energy bills. Wholesale gas prices have hit record highs in Europe and increased by 400% since January. That is largely due to a high global demand and Europe's lower-than-average supplies of gas and storage. The crisis has already forced a wave of collapses among energy suppliers. Experts have warned that British households could also face huge energy bills in the winter. This is while the government is planning to impose a levy on gas bills, which could push the prices further. And that does it for this edition of World News. Bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The Islamic Republic and its outlook of respect towards women versus the Western outlook of objectifying women. The 3rd of February, 2021. I will tell you that sometimes hearts become perplexed and worried about certain matters, but I would tell them that they should not become worried because the signs of this love are fortunately completely tangible in the Islamic government and in the Islamic Republic. The existence of a Basiji movement and spirit, the services of nuclear martyrs, while the people do not know about them in any way, the continuous efforts made by jihadi camps and the sincere scientific and practical endeavors of thousands of young forces throughout the country in cultural, social, and technical fronts are the exquisite manifestations of following the same roadmap drawn by the Commander of the Faithful and Fatimah al-Zahra, greetings be upon her, and their family. Lately, on the issue of the coronavirus, we were witness to one of the most beautiful reflections of following this example through the efforts made by physicians and nurses of the country. Well, regarding women and mothers, the Islamic Republic's view and position on women is completely different from the common Western view, which tries to spread it to the whole world with thousands of languages and podiums. The opposite is the viewpoint of the Islamic Republic. The viewpoint of the Islamic Republic is the view of honoring and respecting women. The opposite point is the Western view of women, which considers women as objects and tools. There is no respect for women in the Western logic, Western philosophy and methodology, and Western lifestyle. You have witnessed that one of the highest-ranking female government and military officials announced just a few months ago that she had been raped and sexually assaulted. Martha McSally, a former US senator, who said that during the time when she served in the Air Force, she had been sexually harassed. In other words, even women of high administrative, social, and political positions were harmed by the Western logic about women, and they are not safe from it.
You've done. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
The President of the Democratic Republic of Congo has authorized United States Special Forces to enter the country and ostensibly help the Congolese army battle ADF rebels, reportedly linked to Daesh terrorist group. Now, Kambale Musavuli, a DRC human rights activist, says ADF are being used as a pretext for U.S. forces to enter his country.
We know in DRC that this is just a pretext to have military presence in the DRC that's continuous. The ADF for us is our weapons of mass destruction. Never been found. We do not know what they do. Yet, it's always a pretext for military presence.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, a program which gives you an alternative view on events taking place in Africa. Today, we are focusing on the move by the United States to send its special forces to the Democratic Republic of Congo under the pretext of fighting the ADF rebel group. We are examining the real reasons behind U.S. military deployment to this mineral-rich country. In the second segment of our program, we are analyzing the digital divide in Africa and how it's impacting negatively on the continent. Stay with us till the end of our show.
U.S. troops in mineral-rich Democratic Republic of Congo. On the night of August 13, 2021, a U.S. Special Forces team arrived in Kinshasa, the capital city of the Democratic Republic of Congo. The alleged objective of this deployment goal is to fight the invisible and fabricated ISIS-Daesh terrorist group. Washington claims the ADF terrorist group, originally from Uganda, is affiliated to ISIS. However, multiple reports, including the UN group of experts, have categorically rejected that any ties exist in the DRC between ISIS terrorist group and rebels known as the Allied Democratic Forces, or the ADF.
The President of the Democratic Republic of Congo, Felix Tshisekedi, has authorized U.S. Special Forces deployment in his country. Now, this decision is in contrast with two former presidents, Laurent Desire Kabila and Joseph Kabila, who resisted attempts by the U.S. to deploy its forces in the country. During his speech at the recent session of the General Assembly of the United Nations, President Tshisekedi said his country has joined a U.S.-led coalition that claims to fight terrorism.
The Democratic Republic of Congo has joined the Global Coalition Against Terrorism as the 24th member. My country is delighted with the decision taken by the coalition's meeting in Rome on the 20th of June to set up within it a working group on terrorism in Africa.
Now, this announcement by Tshisekedi is seen as signaling a major shift in his country's foreign policy, and this might help the U.S. topple China's dominance as Kinshasa's preferred trading partner. Now, to discuss more about the growing U.S. influence in the DRC, we have contacted Carl Gatebuke, the executive director of the African Great Lakes Action Network. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you for having me.
Now, our first question, can you tell us why the Democratic Republic of Congo is unable to effectively combat rebel movements in the East?
One is that the DRC military itself is corrupt. It's made up of a mix of former rebels who were involved in destabilizing the Congo in the first place, people who are who should be facing charges for war crimes and crimes against humanity, but now they're part of the official DRC military. The other part is the destabilizing factor coming from neighboring countries, especially Uganda and Rwanda, Rwanda specifically, having been a major destabilizing force, which is Rwanda and Uganda both supported by the U.S. and the U.K. and now France. The third is that there's so many international organizations, multinationals, and even governments that fuel the conflict in the Congo.
Thanks for that, Mr. Claude Gatebuke.
UN experts said in June that they had not found conclusive evidence of ISIS or Daesh command and control over ADF operations. By ignoring the UN report and explicitly linking the region's militants to ISIS, the US is transforming Eastern Congo into a new front in a so-called war on terror. Of course, ADF rebels continue to operate like many other rebel groups in Eastern DRC, which have caused suffering to civilians. A victim here speaks out.
Cesare, ule vile balibani yaka bana mufunga, mufikiana. Bana
The U.S. claims its special forces are in the DRC to combat ISIS or Daesh-linked ADF rebels, while the U.N. says this group has no links to Daesh. So what's really behind U.S. deployment of troops to the DRC?
Really, what it is a pretext for the U.S. to send, to officially and openly send their troops into the Congo by claiming that there's a group tied with ISIS. Really, what's behind it is, you know, the U.S. has been at trade wars with China for a long time. And at the end of the day, you know, what the U.S. troops are doing in the Congo is not so much to fight Islamic forces ISIS in the Congo. It's actually to secure U.S. interest in the Congo, to ensure that they have a force to protect U.S. interest in the Congo.
Well, Felix Tshisekedi, the president of the Democratic Republic of Congo, has called for a review of mining contracts signed with China in 2008 by his predecessor, saying he wanted to get fairer deals. Now, Mr. Gatebuke, you earlier mentioned that the United States is increasing its military forces in the DRC to counter China. Can you elaborate more on that?
The U.S.-China trade wars it's a global trade war. And Congo is an important part of, you know, the global economy in so many ways. And, you know, the minerals coming out of the Congo, you know, they fuel so many different things. The uranium, the coltan, the gold, you know, so many minerals coming out of the Congo fuel the global economy. And today, I'm convinced that the reason the U.S. is there, and especially with, you know, the renegotiating of the China mining contracts being, you know, announced, is for the U.S. to secure some of these mines. It's an extension of the trade wars. What's happening in the Congo right now, the deployment of these U.S. troops in the Congo, considering these mining contracts, is an extension of the global trade wars between the West and China, and specifically the U.S. and China.
On the 17th of January 1961, 60 years ago, Patrice Lumumba, the first legally elected prime minister of the DRC, was assassinated after being overthrown with the help from Washington. A Congolese citizen here speaks on the anti-colonial legacy of Patrice Lumumba and how current leaders have betrayed this legacy.
Yeah, left us a great legacy. That is working for the people and avoiding influence from Western countries. But we see since the Second Republic, our country is still being dominated by foreign powers.
The United States, through a spy agency, the CIA, assassinated Patrice Lumumba, who was a Congolese independence and revolutionary leader. Having this in mind, what's the opinion of the Congolese people regarding increased U.S. military presence in their country?
Many, many Congolese people, especially a lot of the people who are, you know, who study and analyze the region and study and analyze the Congo, are extremely concerned, and they have cautioned everybody about the presence of U.S. and other foreign troops in the Congo. So it's mixed. Mostly those who are well-informed are against the presence of U.S. military in the Congo, and generally.
The presence of rebels committing atrocities in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo raises questions about the functionality of the United Nations Stabilization Mission in the DRC, known by its French acronym, MONUSCO. This is UN's largest peacekeeping operation with 20,000 troops on the ground for the past 20 years. However, these UN troops have been unable to eliminate the rebels. Locals are now protesting the ineffectiveness of the UN forces.
We denounce the ineffectiveness of the UN force MONUSCO, which has an offensive mission, but which for years has failed to do anything. MONUSCO must either act or pack up. We want to mobilize the national and international opinion in the face of this tragedy.
Now, the United Nations peacekeeping force in the Eastern DRC has failed to stop attacks on civilians. Why is such a large force unable to fulfill its mandate?
These UN troops are actually, in fact, many of them taking a part in the looting, you know, stealing of resources in the Congo, literally. You know, some of them are like smuggling and selling gold and other minerals. Some of them have been caught committing violence and sexual violence against the Congolese women. UN forces, where instead of carrying out the mission of protecting civilians, they actually are doing harm to the civilians. So it's a shame that so much money has been spent, so many troops are in the Congo, and they are not protecting civilians.
Thanks a lot, Mr. Agatabuke, for your analysis. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is about how the digital divide is slowing literacy in Africa. Stay with us.
Digital divide slowing literacy in Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
A report issued during this year's International Literacy Day has revealed that lack of access to computers and electricity is impacting negatively on literacy across Africa amid the COVID-19 pandemic.
The report by the United Nations Educational, Scientific and Cultural Organization, or UNESCO, titled Literacy for a Human-Centered Recovery, Narrowing the Digital Divide, notes that in sub-Saharan Africa, only 7.7% were estimated to have a computer at home, while household internet access in the region is still limited with a rate of approximately 22%.
Now, despite the grim situation, there are efforts by organizations such as UNESCO to provide schools with internet access and computers. A teacher in the remote region of northern Kenya explains here how internet access has changed learning.
Internet has been a game changer, even in the performance and even the grades of our students here in school. So now many of them, because they can learn on their own, they can discover things on their own, their attitude has changed greatly. When they have the tablets, the learning becomes more interesting because there are different ways of accessing the same information.
Now to discuss how lack of access to computers and internet is affecting literacy levels in Africa and possible solutions to this problem, we have contacted Julius Mbaluto, a London-based African affairs analyst. Thanks a lot, sir, for your time.
It's okay. Pleasure.
Now, Mr. Mbaluto, in your opinion, how serious is the digital divide in Africa and its impact on literacy?
Africa has got a very huge population. The population of Africa is like very youthful, a lot of them, and also they love technology. Most of them are techno-safi, but the governments have not managed to successfully bridge that gap of technology divide. So when you look into the West, most of these countries in the West, they are extremely covered well in terms of connectivity, whether you talk in terms of internet, accessibility, and also in terms of even affordability, which means like it's easier for a lot more people in the West to afford a laptop or even iPad or even a computer. But it isn't the same story for Africa, because in Africa, most of the time, then it's a question of affordability.
Thanks for watching, Julius Mbaluto, African Affairs Analyst.
Most African governments must step up investment in information communication technology or ICT infrastructure to help students and employees work and study from home in this era of COVID-19 and beyond. Have African governments failed in their duties to bridge the digital divide, especially during this COVID-19 pandemic?
A huge population of schools, whether university, whether primary or even secondary, they didn't have the technology to enabling them to learn at home. And also in terms of lack of that technology means even some schools don't even have the computers that can even help them to do the same. So it's just a few that can manage that. So if you look into a country with challenges of technology and connectivity, indeed is a question of governance. It's a question of a government probably never really provided the infrastructure in school to make sure schools can function efficiently no matter what season of life comes.
UNESCO says the pandemic and its repercussions have also magnified the pre-existing inequalities in access to meaningful literacy learning opportunities, disproportionately affecting 773 million non-literate young people and adults, mostly in Africa. A South African student says remote learning at home came with lots of challenges.
Remote learning was very difficult for me because we didn't have internet and the school taught us through WhatsApp. Since my mother was not working at the time, I was constantly worried that she could not afford data so that I could do my work.
What short-term and long-term steps are needed to remove the existing disparities in access to internet across Africa?
In terms of technology, it's about time Africa begins to focus on being self-reliant. And when you look into capabilities, if you go again to Kenya, the youthful generation of Kenya devised the most advanced system in the world for money transfer, known as M-Pesa. That one, even the West cannot reach that level. And you can see now, when given the chance, when youth's potential has been actually exploited, how far Africa can go. So it's about Africa, time for Africa to begin to look for solutions to the problems that Africa is facing. And also, without shy, government have to invest in these technologies.
While most developed countries move their classes online with ease, many developing countries have been found wanting due to a lack of infrastructure and the high cost of gadgets to access the internet, such as laptops, computers, and smartphones.
Now, in a move towards self-reliance in IT gadgets, Kenya recently opened Africa's first nanotechnology and semiconductors factory. Now, the country's president, Uhuru Kenyatta, speaks here during the official opening of the factory.
We are already, from here, the first African country. We are selling microprocessors. We are selling to the United States now. We are selling to France. We are selling to Japan from Kenya. This is going to be the future for us to be able to now make our own motherboards, and from making our own motherboards to making our own television sets to making our own mobile telephones. These are all new opportunities that are all going to be created from this seemingly very small but very critical foundation towards our manufacturing agenda for our republic. So I thank you, and I take this opportunity also to thank Deren Kimathi University, and I want to thank them for also being visionary, not being difficult, allowing to give these young entrepreneurs seeking to come home, to bring their knowledge home, to give them space, to allow them to work with members of your staff, to enable them to engage with your students. Asante sana. This would not have happened without your support. So, Bwana Kioni, Vice Chancellor, hongera kwako na viongozi wote wa Dedan Kimathi University.
Importation of gadgets such as computers and mobile phones has made these tools inaccessible to millions of poor students in Africa. Now, how can these challenges be solved?
We have all across Africa, we have all these professors who have studied in the West in terms of technology. We have very capable people in terms of technologies and importation. Why not begin again to make our own computers? There's nothing wrong with that. We can make our own computers in Africa if we, again, we harness all this. And it's just not a country-to-country thing. Yeah? I think this should be like a clarion call for African Union to bring countries together, to look, you know, bring all the potentials, like potential, harness that potential of experts across Africa, depending on whichever country it is, just identify them. Begin to, like, what can you do for your country? Can you start a plant? Can you begin to give back to society? And this hub, can it be a hub for manufacturing computers, laptops? Even if you start in a very small scale way, one day it's going to grow, one day it's going to be big.
Now, while access to technology is critical in improving literacy, especially during the current pandemic, are African countries ready to have their own internet ecosystem to avoid digital colonialism and over-reliance on Western countries?
I want to address every country in Africa that claims and loves what they call sovereignty. I value that. Sovereignty is one of the most important things. But without your own internet, seriously, you're exposed. That's what I want to say. Simply put, you're exposed. The one controlling the technologies can see everything, every your plan, every bit of your tomorrow, every bit of your vision. They see through it. And therefore, you are not free. And therefore, I am advocating African internet for African countries, and also as systems that each country can protect itself, even in terms of security, and actually manage to control everything, every aspect of life in that country in a way that a foreign nation cannot interfere, cannot change, cannot violate security, cannot do anything. That's what sovereignty is about, being independent, being in control of your destiny, being able to control your systems, having your own system that cannot be violated even by interferences of the West. That's the key thing for Africa.
Well, Mr. Mbaluto there says that for Africa to be truly independent, it needs to have its own internet infrastructure to avoid digital colonialism. Well, that's all the time we had for this edition of Africa Today. It's been great having you. Do drop us a line through our social media handle and send us your comments. God bless you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints. I'm your host, Muzaffar Haider. Here in the studio with a smiling face, we have Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Ali. Assalamu alaikum to both of you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So we've entered into a new phase of media censorship. The Western media has a long track record of actually censoring the voice of the revolution, the voice of Iran, the voice of the Islamic Republic, the voice of people anywhere, everywhere, who speak out against the system anyway. But now we've actually entered a phase where they've seized the websites of Press TV and Al Masira and Al Alam and other such channels out there. Now, this is a little bit strange. This actually shows us that the enemy is more on edge, it seems, than ever was before. The election of Sayyid Raisi may have a big part to play in this. I'd like to get your opening thoughts on this entire thing. I think Sheikh Ali.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So this is nothing new, like you pointed out in your opening statement. When we look at the track record of the Western hegemonic governments and their affiliated apparatus, right? Even, you know, I would go to a point where United Nations and other so-called international organizations, they're part of that whole strategy and that whole plan. They have been silencing the word of logic, the word of rationality, the word of tolerance, the word of exposing the evil and standing up and resisting against the evil. Mm-hmm. This is nothing new. It has been going on throughout the history, even before this electronic media existed, right? If you look at the history, back in the day too, they would silence people from talking about and bringing up the realities of this world, right? Mm-hmm. So this is nothing new. Now, why is it happening now? Again, like you pointed out, I think the enemy, you know, they've realized that they're losing on the propagation and propaganda field as well. For instance, one of the examples, just to elaborate on this point, you look at the anti-Israel sentiment in the entire world. Right, especially the Western countries, right, where they praised back in the day, they praised the Zionist regime, and you know, in the name of human rights and so on and so forth, and rights for Jewish people and so on and so forth. Now, if you go and talk to those people, because I've been in touch, right, 10, 15 years ago, the anti-Israel sentiment was very insignificant 15 years
and
ago.
And it was limited to kind of clusters of activist groups,
exactly.
And Muslims,
exactly.
Some
and,
Muslims.
And non-Muslims too. It was very, very contained, right? It was not the mainstream narrative. Now, fast forwarding, especially after the social media and, you know, the officers of the software that are out there, the way they have raised the information level and the facts that they have presented and the logical discourses that they have presented, it has compelled many people out there, especially in the West. I keep saying West because I know in America, you know, when I used to read anytime there's a news report about Palestine or Israel in one of the mainstream news outlets, I used to read comments. You know, I think you all do every once in a while, you know, just to see what's going on, how are people. Well, back in the day, 15 years ago maybe, you would hardly find maybe one or two people exposing the crimes of the Zionist regime, right? Most of the people, they were, like I pointed out, they were supportive in one way or the other. But now if you go on any of these news, now the news channels have to delete those comments.
Yeah, often they'll say comments are not allowed.
Right? Why are they doing it? Because they're losing on that battlefield as well, and it has changed the perception of the people of the world, the general masses of the world.
I'm going to want to come back to this, but Sayyid Mahdi, so Sheikh Ali pointed out how previously, if you go 10, 15 years back, the negative sentiments towards Israel were lower than they are today. And we talked about how the activists and those small clusters of groups that existed back then who were pro-Palestine, they were contained back then, and now it's not so contained. Now, my question to you is, these groups obviously did a lot of propagation, they did lots of work, they created posters, they held up banners, they went to the protests, and all those kinds of things. To what extent do you feel that they have had an impact on the wider audiences out there?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It's a very good point, it's a very solid point, that even a small group